Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Those About to Die by Daniel P. Mannix. Narrated by Brian P. Craig. Foreword. A place without justice or mercy, where only the smart or ruthless could survive. I first read Daniel Mannix's mind-boggling history of the Roman games when I was about 14. I think I read it at one sitting, or, more probably, huddled under the bedsheets with a flashlight, so no one would see my eyeballs popping out with amazement at the bloodletting in the Colosseum. Although his gore-dipped history is based on the evidence and accounts of the period, Mannix, his very name sounds like a gladiator from conquered Gaul, had a terrific ability, like a good popular novelist, to make the scenes come alive, to take you there. Rereading it, I can still feel my jaw go slack with astonishment. The staggering numbers involved, the animals and humans slaughtered, the unspeakable acts of cruelty are almost beyond comprehension. Pompey boasted of having 10,000 men killed over the course of 8 spectacles, and at one show he pitched 20 elephants, 600 lions, and over 400 leopards against Gaetulians armed with darts. After Trajan's victory over the Dacians, he had 11,000 animals slaughtered by bestiarii, gladiators who specialized in animal killing. Bulls and jackasses were trained to rape women. Stadia were flooded so that opposing navies could fight to the death. Crocodiles and hippos were sent into the water to attack anyone who had fallen in. In fact, every conceivable way of torturing and killing men, women, and children was devised to amuse, impress, and appease the Roman mob. The cost, of course, was staggering. One politician complained that it's cost me 3 inheritances to stop the mouth of the people. But as we all know, it still costs our pals a pretty penny to shove themselves down our throats. The gladiators were not all hopeless wretches condemned to certain death. They had their special skills and were proud of them. Retarians with their trident and net, Secutors with shield and sword, Dimichiri skilled with the dagger, Parthian bowmen, Assyrians and their deadly flails, German javelin specialists, Sikhs from the Indian subcontinent with their razor-sharp throwing rings, red-headed Irishmen armed only with their skull-splitting shillelaghs, and the immaculate discipline of the Greek hoplites. They could make money. Lots of it if they were particularly skilled and lucky. They could have women, lots of them, and high-born ones, too. And they could win their freedom. In fact, the Roman writer Epictetus says that gladiators used to pray for more fights so they could distinguish themselves and make more money. One of the great pleasures of this little classic is the way Mannix brings real gladiators to life. Basing his mini-biographies on actual historical evidence, he breathes life and death into characters we only know from grave inscriptions and contemporary historians. The world of the Roman games, so vividly portrayed in Those About to Die, seems at first sight to be unbelievable in its ferocity. "That couldn't happen now," we hear ourselves saying. But the Roman populace, who screamed with laughter at the sight of fellow humans, defenseless women and children as well as gladiators, being torn apart by beasts, or roasted alive, or crucified, or hacked to death, cannot be dismissed as safely ancient. We only need to look into the mouths of the gas chambers, the killing fields of Cambodia, the mass graves of Rwanda and Kosovo, to realize that the mob is always with us, and it's always howling for blood. Michael Stevenson, former editor-in-chief, The Military Book Club. 1. Nero was emperor, and for 2 weeks the mob had been rioting uncontrolled in the streets of Rome. The economy of the greatest empire that the world had ever seen was coming apart like an unraveling sweater. The cost of maintaining Rome's gigantic armed forces, equipped with the latest catapults, ballistae, and fast war galleys, was bleeding the nation white, and in addition there were the heavy subsidies that had to be paid to the satellite nations dependent on Rome for support. The impoverished government had neither the funds nor the power to stop the riots. In this crisis, the captain of the shipping hurried by chariot to consult with the first tribune. "The merchant fleet is in Egypt awaiting loading," he announced. "The ships can be loaded either with corn for the starving people or with the special sand used on the track for the chariot races. Which shall it be?" "Are you mad?" screamed the tribune. "The situation here has got out of control. The emperor's a lunatic, the army's on the edge of mutiny, and the people are dying of hunger. For the gods' sake, get the sand. We have to get their minds off their troubles." Soon, special announcement was made by heralds that the finest chariot races on record would be held at the Circus Maximus. 300 pairs of gladiators would fight to the death, and 1,200 condemned criminals would be eaten by lions. Fights between elephants and rhinos, buffalo and tigers, and leopards and wild boars would be staged. As a special feature, 20 beautiful young girls would be raped by jackasses. Admission to the rear seats, free. Small charge for the first 36 tiers of seats. Everything else was promptly forgotten. The gigantic stadium, seating 385,000 people, was jammed to capacity. For 2 weeks, the games went on while the crowd cheered, made bets, and got drunk. Once again, the government had a breathing space to try to find some way out of its difficulties. The games, as these incredible spectacles were politely called, were a national institution. Millions of people were dependent on them for a living. Animal trappers, gladiator trainers, horse breeders, shippers, contractors, armorers, stadium attendants, promoters, and businessmen of all kinds. To have abolished the games would have thrown so many people out of work that the national economy would have collapsed. In addition, the games were the narcotic that kept the Roman mob doped up so the government could operate. A performer named Pilates contemptuously told Augustus Caesar, "Your position depends on how we keep the mob amused." Juvenal wrote bitterly, "The people who have conquered the world now only have two interests, bread and circuses." In a sense, the people were trapped. Rome had overextended herself. She had become, as much by accident as design, the dominant nation of the world. The cost of maintaining the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, over most of the known world was proving too great even for the enormous resources of the mighty empire. But Rome did not dare to abandon her allies or pull back her legions, who were holding the barbarian tribes in a line extending from the Rhine in Germany to the Persian Gulf. Every time that a frontier post was relinquished, the wild hordes would sweep in, overrun the area, and move just that much closer to the nerve centers of Roman trade. So the Roman government was constantly threatened by bankruptcy, and no statesman could find a way out of the difficulty. The cost of its gigantic military program was only one of Rome's headaches. To encourage industry in her various satellite nations, Rome attempted a policy of unrestricted trade, but the Roman working man was unable to compete with the cheap foreign labor and demanded high tariffs. When the tariffs were passed, the satellite nations were unable to sell their goods to the only nation that had any money. To break the deadlock, the government was finally forced to subsidize the Roman working class to make up the difference between their real wages, the actual value of what they were producing, and the wages required to keep up their relatively high standard of living. As a result, thousands of workmen lived on this subsidy and did nothing whatever, sacrificing their standard of living for a life of ease. The wealthy class of Rome, living in palaces and eating banquets composed of such delicacies as thrushes' tongues and wild honey, and sows' udders stuffed with fried baby mice, owed their riches to great factories where slave laborers produced enormous masses of goods by what we now call assembly line methods. The dispossessed farmers and unemployed workmen had one great cry: let the rich pay. The government responded by increasing taxes year after year on the plutocrats, but there was a point beyond which they dared not go. After all, it was the taxes paid by these rich men that kept the whole system going, and the government did not dare to ruin them. Attempts were made to abolish slave labor in the factories, but the free workmen's demand for short hours and high wages had grown so great that only slaves could be used economically. Also, the big factory owners were politically powerful and fought every effort to break up their holdings by bribing senators, hiring lobbyists, and securing the support of unscrupulous labor leaders. A Roman factory owner found it far more profitable to spend thousands of sesterces in such practices rather than lose his slaves. And the Roman freeman would far rather have his dole and games than work for a living. To the Roman mob, caught in an economic tangle it could not comprehend and was unable to break, the circus was the only panacea for its troubles. The great amphitheaters became the ordinary man's temple, home, place of assembly, and ideal. As the games were ostensibly pious ceremonies given in honor of the gods, they gratified his religious sense. He was able for a few hours at least to inhabit an edifice more magnificent than the golden palace of Nero instead of a miserable, overcrowded tenement. Here he was able to meet with other freemen, feel a sense of unity as he sat with his faction cheering a certain chariot team, and impose his wishes on the emperor himself, for, as the Romans themselves said, in the circus alone are the people rulers. The Romans worshipped courage, and every Roman liked to picture himself as a rough, tough fighter. In Rome, the little guy could identify himself with a successful gladiator as a modern fight fan can identify himself with a famous prize fighter. There were other attractions. Betting ran so high that fortunes were won or lost in the circus within a few minutes, and only by betting could the ordinary freeman obtain wealth. Also, no matter how badly off a Roman might be, he had the satisfaction of knowing that he was superior to the poor wretches in the arena. Although few Romans cared for the low pay and rigid discipline of the army, they could still consider themselves real fighting men as they shouted advice and insults to the struggling gladiators below. Nothing delighted the Roman mob more than to have some visiting dignitary from a satellite nation get sick during the games and have to rush from the amphitheater. The freeman would say with great satisfaction, "Those effeminate Greeks, they can't take the sight of blood like us Romans," and turn to the next event with renewed relish. The games, which eventually came to cost one-third of the total income of the empire and used up thousands of animals and humans every month, started out as festivals no more bloodthirsty than the average county fair. The first games, in 238 BC, featured exhibitions of trick riding, acrobats, wire walkers, trained animals, chariot racing, and athletic events. There was boxing with soft leather straps over the knuckles that took the place of gloves. The militia staged a sham battle, and the crack cavalry corps, composed of rich young men mounted on thoroughbred horses and dressed in gold and silver armor, went through a drill. There were also horse races in which the riders had to jump from one horse to another in full gallop. Occasionally, a pageant was held, such as the Siege of Troy, in which a wooden mock-up representing Troy was attacked by militiamen dressed as Greek soldiers and finally burned amid much blowing of trumpets and loud applause. An admission fee was charged by whoever was producing the show. Later, this sort of exhibition got much too tame for the Romans. The only one of the events to last was the chariot racing, which, like modern horse racing, was a perfect sport for betting. However, even the chariot racing completely changed its character. Instead of being simply a race, it became bloody and exciting enough to hold popular interest. The Circus Maximus, the oldest amphitheater in Rome, was especially designed for chariot racing. Although in the early days the games were held in any open field convenient to the city and the chariots simply raced along a course marked off on the ground, I'll describe the Circus Maximus races in about 50 AD to give an idea of the sport at its height. Originally built about 530 BC, the Circus Maximus measured 1,800 feet long by 600 feet wide, more than twice the size of the Yankee Stadium. It was shaped like a long U. At the open end of the U were the stalls for the chariots, with doors that could all be thrown open at the same instant as in the start of modern horse races. Down the center of the amphitheater ran a long barricade called the spine, and the chariots had to circle the spine 7 times, a total distance of about 4 miles. The spine was the show spot of the whole circus. There were statues on the columns, fountains spurting perfumed water, altars to the gods, and even a small temple dedicated to the Venus of the Sea, the special patron goddess of charioteers. The charioteers always burned incense to this Venus before beginning a race. In the center of the spine was an obelisk imported from Egypt, surmounted by a golden ball. This ball gleamed brilliantly in the sun and was the most noticeable object in the circus. The obelisk, minus the ball, now stands in the center of St. Peter's Square in Rome, before the cathedral. Near the ends of the spine were 2 columns, each surmounted by a crossbar of marble. On 1 crossbar was mounted a line of marble eggs. There was a line of dolphins on the other. The eggs were the symbol of Castor and Pollux, the heavenly twins who were the patron saints of Rome, and the dolphins were sacred to Neptune, the patron of horses. Every time the chariot circled the course, an egg and a dolphin were removed so the crowd could tell how many laps had been run. At the extreme ends of the spine were set 3 cones some 20 feet high and ornamented with bas-reliefs. These cones, called metai, acted as bumpers to keep the elegant spine from being damaged by the chariots on the turns. Pliny says the metai looked like cypress trees. The racing was managed by a number of big corporations that were regarded as the most important money-making enterprise in the Roman world and had thousands of stockholders. Stock in these companies was so valuable that it was carefully passed on from father to son as a priceless possession. These corporations maintained huge offices in the heart of the business districts in all main cities, as well as in Rome itself. In addition to these offices, the companies owned great blocks of buildings near the various circuses. There was a circus of some sort in virtually every town in the empire, and these buildings served as barracks and stables. The buildings were usually set around a track for exercising the teams. The companies also owned countless stud farms and even maintained fleets of ships with built-in stalls for transporting horses from one circus to another. The size of the stud farms may be imagined by the remark of a government agent who, in 550 AD, when it was finally necessary to abolish the racing, was sent around to break up the farms. He said of one place, "It was already so reduced that the owner has only about 400 horses left, so I decided that it was not worth bothering about." The number of men employed by these companies, including herdsmen, ostlers, drivers, breakers, and so on, is unknown, but it is interesting to look at a partial list of the men engaged in the actual race itself. In addition to the charioteers, there were the Medici, doctors, the Origatores, the charioteer's assistants, the Procuratores Dromi, men who smoothed the sand before the race, the Conditores, who greased the chariot wheels, the Moratores, who grabbed the horses at the end, the Sparsores, who cleaned the chariots, the Erectores, who took down the eggs and dolphins, and the Armentarii, grooms. In addition, there were also the stable boys, trainers, vets, saddlers, tailors, stable guards, dressers, and waterers. There was even a special group who did nothing but talk to the horses and cheer them on as they were being led from their stalls. The charioteers themselves were mostly slaves, although a few freemen volunteered for the job in hopes of winning fame and fortune. Slave or not, a successful charioteer was the hero of Rome and could win huge sums. Several retired as millionaires, having either bought their freedom or been given it by a grateful master who shared in the winnings. The Emperor Caligula gave Eutychus, a famous charioteer, 2 million sesterces, about $85,000, as a gift. Crescens, an African who started racing when he was 13, won $75,000 before he was killed at 22. He won 38 races snatched at the post, that is, came from behind in the last lap to win, which was considered an especially praiseworthy feat. One man won 15 purses of gold in an hour. Although the usual sum paid to a winning charioteer was only about $2,500, he received much more in bonuses from the company, gifts from admirers, bribes from bettors who wanted tips, and concerns who wanted to use his picture on vases, trays, and souvenir cameos. Probably the most famous charioteer was a little, dark, wiry fellow named Diocles. He was the first man to win 1,000 races. Diocles had a passion for horses and fine clothes. He swaggered around Rome in a silk tunic and embroidered linens, and owned his own teams, which was as unusual as for a modern jockey to have a racing stable. Juvenal wrote bitterly, "Decent men groan to see this ex-slave with an income 100 times that of a senator," but Diocles was a popular idol. He had started life as a slave groom to a Spanish nobleman, been shipped to Rome with a cargo of horses, and bought by a patrician who admired the boy's uncanny skill with temperamental thoroughbreds. He drove his first race at the age of 24, and being a newcomer, was illegally forced to take the outside track. Positions were supposedly chosen by lot, but there was a good deal of crookedness about the selections. To reach the rail, an outside chariot had to cut in front of the others, which meant almost certain death. Diocles didn't try it. He tailed the others until the last lap, and then by a magnificent piece of driving, passed the other three chariots to win. It was customary for the owner of a racing stable to split the purse with the charioteer, so Diocles soon made enough money to buy his freedom. He then put his winnings into buying horses, trained them himself, and got his own chariot. He usually drove stallions and collected over $40,000 a year for stud fees alone. In addition to his other privileges, Diocles, like all famous charioteers, was allowed on certain days to play April Fool-type jokes on anyone he wished, even members of the nobility. Another lucrative source of income for Diocles was making freak runs for big side bets. Once he raced twice in one day, the first time with a six-horse hitch, swinging a six in hand around the ends of the spine at full speed was a terrific feat, and won 40,000 sesterces. Then he raced a seven-horse hitch, not yoked, held only with traces, and won 50,000. Perhaps his most remarkable stunt was winning a race without using a whip for a side bet of 30,000 sesterces. The whip was used by the charioteers not so much to beat the teams as to guide them on the turns. While rounding the cones at the end of the spine at full speed, the charioteer could signal the inside horse when to turn by laying his whip on its shoulder. And if one of the other horses tried to turn too soon, the driver could check him by a light flick. The reins were tied around the charioteer's waist so he could get more leverage on the turns, but this made it difficult to control any individual horse. The horses were extremely valuable, worth far more than slaves. Training started when the horses were 3 years old and was so detailed that a horse could not be raced until he was five. Some teams were so smart that they could drive themselves. One driver fell out when his team made the usual jackrabbit start from the stalls, but the horses kept going and actually won the race. They got the prize, too. Sculptors made statues of famous horses, some of which still remain. Under the statues are inscriptions such as Tuscus, driven by Fortunatus of the Blues, 386 wins, and Victor, driven by Gita of the Greens, 429 wins. Lucius Verres had a horse named Volucris, who was awarded a bushel of gold pieces after a race, and the Emperor Hadrian put up a mausoleum for his horse, Borysthenes, that still stands. The most famous of these horses was Incitatus, belonging to the Emperor Caligula. Incitatus had a marble bedroom, an ivory manger, and drank from a gold bucket. Famous artists decorated the walls of his stall, and he attended state dinners where his oats and corn were served to him by his special slaves. Caligula even planned to have him made a consul. A horse that had won over 100 races was called a centenarius and wore a special harness. Diocles owned 9 centenarii, all of which he had trained himself. He had one horse that had won over 200 races. This horse, named Passerinus, was so revered that soldiers patrolled the streets when he was sleeping to keep people from making any noise. The best horse in the team was always on the near hand, left side of the hitch, and never yoked, only held by traces. On the turns, this horse was nearest to the spine, and his speed and sure-footedness meant the difference between life and death to the driver. The second best horse was on the offside, right of the hitch, and was usually not yoked either. On the turns, he had to jerk the chariot around while the centenarius on the inside pivoted close to the cones. The two center horses were yoked on either side of the shaft and were mainly for pulling power, although the whole team had to know their jobs. As today, there were unending arguments about the best breeds and best farms. The horses were not shod, so the condition of their feet was crucial. The Sicilian horses were very fast but unreliable, the Iberians good only for a short course, feet too soft, and the Libyan best for a long drag. There were several breeds we do not have today, among them the Oryx, which was striped like a zebra but was apparently a domestic breed of horse. Although there are innumerable statues of Roman charioteers in museums, And although we have plenty of old records of the sport, such as Scorpus of the White Faction got first place 7 times, second place 29 times, and third place 60 times, I haven't...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?